Hi, this is the Acquire podcast from the Audphonic Podcast Network, and I'm Jenny Wright. This is the podcast that delves deep into the world of list building and online events, and it's designed to empower entrepreneurs and marketers with the knowledge and strategies to master these essential business growth tactics. And we have an incredible guest. This is Jonathan Green with us today, and he is the master of prolific writing and effective book promotion. And so, Jonathan, I'm really glad you're here. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to finally connect and make this happen.
Absolutely. We had a couple tech issues trying to get this recording done, but here we are. It's good. So you have a fascinating journey to share, and it's one that's going to leave, I think, our listeners pretty inspired and share some really great ways that people can do launches with their books. And you are the best-selling author of ChatGPT Profits and Serve No Master, as well as an impressive catalog of over 300 other books, some ghostwritten, some written by yourself. And this is amazing. You are no stranger to the world of writing, book promotion, and all that great stuff. So this is where it gets really exciting. You're also with your celebrity ghost writer status and artificial intelligence expertise. So that is marrying two things together that's going to make sure you have a very long and prolific future. So in this episode, we are going to unravel the mystery behind promoting your book effectively. We're not going to talk about the usual tactics. You can get that on Google. We really want to look into these lesser known hidden gems that can make your book soar. So we're going to discover how to do this and create those coveted book reviews, get your masterpiece into the hands of eager readers. Thank you. This is going to be a lot of fun. So let's dive in real quick. Can you share some of these unconventional methods that people use to effectively promote their books, the ones that people just don't know about?
Yeah, there's a couple of strategies that are lesser known. There's a lot of really interesting things happening on TikTok. I've seen some authors, and that's something I play around with, where you can build an audience and you just talk about your writing journey because people are very interested in that. And it's a very cool new way to do it. Not a lot of authors, especially because a lot of authors, like, we're a little bit older. We're like, oh, TikTok's for kids. That's a huge place to do it. That's one of the new strategies that's very interesting. Some people I've worked with have done very well, and it's a little lesser known. It's a new one. The other really critical part is to begin your process by saying, my job is to sell books. Like, it's, if you say you're an author, you think I write books. That's easy. Once you start, and it's crazy to say that because I know writing a book is really hard. That shows how much harder selling books is. So the most important strategy that I've developed is alliances. I'm a huge fan of cooperative ventures with other authors, and I try all sorts of different types of them. If you've ever seen like a virtual summit or a conference where a bunch of authors are speaking, I try to create that type of environment. So I had this revelation a few years ago because I used to think every author is my enemy. I said, if someone's reading their book, that means that person's not reading my book. So I was always very competitive. And I had this revelation one day. I said, you know, I don't know anyone who has only one business book. Like, if you've ever been to someone's house and they have those dating books, they have like 50. They never have just one. They never go, I read this book and it worked and I'm done. You never see that. Whatever they're into. And I certainly I'm not loyal. I read a lot of science fiction. I'm not loyal to one author, and then I don't read other authors in the same space. And that's, you see that where you have those books that are a bunch of short story collections where they're like, oh, they're doing something cooperative. So that type of idea. And I started thinking about, what if I could get the kind of result of a virtual summit with less work? And so I started doing these group book giveaways. I've cold emailed probably every author on Amazon by now. I probably emailed 20,000, 30,000 people one by one saying, hey, I saw your book in the charts, would be interested in doing a cooperative venture. And what you do is I'll share your book with my audience and you share my book with your audience. And we usually try to get like 10 authors, like a smaller, so it's not a crazy number. And so that way everyone is kind of on the same page when you show a screen. And I run it two different ways. I think the best version is where each author, and this comes from learning, I make the actual page and the download page for that person so that everyone's page looks the same. Because originally the original version was, oh, everyone makes their own opt-in page or their own landing page to give away their book. And then the person who's better at that will get more, and it's not fair. And fair is really important.
Yeah.
Because then the marketers win. So I said, so it's more work for me, but I have to design every page and I just make them look like the Amazon page. So it's just a picture of your book, an email address button, and then a page. And then each person gets a spreadsheet with all the email addresses of people that took their book. So it's 100% on the up and up. Mm-hmm. We don't do oh, you opt in and you get all the books. No, you have to choose which books you want. And this is very effective because it's turning lead into gold. What happens is there are people on my list, 10% of the people who read my email today are thinking about unsubscribing at any given time. We're all that way, right?
Yeah.
We all have some email we got today that we're like thinking about, should I just unsubscribe? Am I bored of this? Should I cancel the subscription? Right. I don't really watch that much Netflix. Every month we have this conversation, my family, should we just cancel it? And it's the same thing. So that 10% of people go, oh, bunch of free books. That's interesting. And what happens is they will come and they will jump to someone else's. So someone might leave me and jump to your book, read your book and go, you know what? I am in love with Jenny. So what happens is a bad fan of mine, right? A bottom tier fan, someone who's barely interested, right? Becomes a super fan of someone else.
Mm-hmm.
And then your 10% that are bored of you will jump to me. So I don't get fans of equal value. I get fans of significantly higher value, people that are customers, people that are ready to spend money, people that become super engaged and they're excited again. And the reason Book of Giveaways are so powerful is that they attract the exact right person, because every single person has bought a book, right? So they came in, even though they're getting my book for free, they're not the same as normal freebie seekers, which people in marketing talk about. If someone comes to your website, downloads a free gift, they often are very inactive, or they'll give you a fake email address, get the free gift and disappear.
Absolutely.
There are a lot of people that don't buy stuff online. The beauty of people that come in this way is they might not have bought my book, but they bought a book and then they came to my book. So they're all buyers. They're people that buy stuff online, right? Not everyone will spend money online. And so they're in the second category. So they're worth more. They're more engaged. And people that like books, not everyone likes books. I remember in high school, someone once told me, I haven't read a book in over 2 years. I've only read one magazine article in the last 2 years. And he was so proud. That's not my ideal customer. My ideal customer, and there's a big correlation between reading and income and reading and spending power. So I want people that see books as valuable and actually want a free, because there's a lot of people, you could have a bunch of free books outside and they go, I don't want it. They don't see, they don't read, so they don't care. So it attracts the right people, repels the wrong people. Mm-hmm. And it's a really powerful way to run. And the thing about these events is that every single author always gets more email addresses than they started with. So
that's
nobody has a net negative. Usually they get double. So if someone sends in 100 people, they'll get 200 or more. And they get like this really huge benefit, because nobody takes all the books. Say that right now. Most people take 3 or 4. So people actually are very deliberate, because you have to go to the page, enter email address and go back. So it actually does, it's a better value as well, because they've picked you.
Mm-hmm.
So they looked at a group of books on the shelf. They said, oh, here's the top 10 bestsellers. I'll take these 3. And it creates this really cool effect for you. And it allows you to kind of rejuvenate your list, rejuvenate your audience, mm-hmm. get fresh voice. People in. So this is the most effective strategy that I've used. It is a lot of work, because a lot of authors are bad marketers, or they don't actually have control of their book. And so you do get some hard pushbacks. I do get not very often. It's usually because I don't use software to manage this. I actually have a spreadsheet, and sometimes I'll remail someone on accident and they'll send back a mean email like, hey, I told you 6 months ago, I never want to participate in one of your events. I'm like, oh, sorry. Because sometimes people would say, oh, I want to do the next one. And that's the one negative of it, is that you do have to message, but most people either don't respond, which is fine, or they're very positive.
Mm-hmm.
Very rarely get the negative response. I don't mind a non-response. So it's people who participate always get a massive benefit. We've never had someone have a negative experience, not even close.
Yeah.
And that's what's really important. So for me, it has to be a win for the author and the reader. So the readers get good books for free, because I have to, you know, I screen them out. We look for, does a book have a certain number of reviews? Sometimes a book will have low reviews, but the author has a past book with a lot of reviews. So we look at that. So it's never a book, oh, this is a brand new book with no reviews, here you go.
Mm-hmm.
There's a level of quality control that's important. This works really well in other spaces, even more in nonfiction, even more in the fiction space. So this, I really kind of revolutionized this in nonfiction, but it's so much more powerful in romance or in science fiction.
Sure.
And again, you have like a lot of authors in that space. There's two types of authors. The authors who really get it, or the authors who have no idea. So it can go either way. But when you get authors that kind of get it, they're like, yeah, of course. There's no hesitation. They have a lot of strategy around it. And this is the biggest strategy that I use for boosting a book. Mm-hmm. And it's a strategy I'll even use for a client. I'll set up an event in their space. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, they have a book in the space. And we'll just message a ton of people. It's very easy to find contact information for authors. Even people don't realize that most websites, the contact form just goes to the author's email address. So we fill in contact forms all the time. It's usually a pretty good response rate. So if I can't find their email address, I'll do that. I don't message people on social media. That's never worked for me, but mm-hmm. just the cold email strategy has been very effective for me.
Okay.
Every author.
This is a really cool, well, you know that I love online events. Like, I've run over 350 online summits. I do a lot of book promotions as well. I've never done an event like you're describing, but it is not so far out of what I have done that it's not possible. Like, this is something that I can, as you're talking about it, it's a totally doable strategy. I can see the benefits of doing something like this. Collaboration is always better than trying to go it alone, if you ask me, unless you have the social media following and the email list so that you can do it alone. But I absolutely love, I always say that I'm not in competition, I'm in collaboration. And I'd rather work in collaboration with people in the exact same field as me than in competition with them, because you can get a lot farther when you work with people, obviously. So if I can sort of summarize a little bit about this event style, right? So it's obviously an online event. You obviously have to have a promotional period. You obviously have to have a funnel, right? Enter your name and email. You get access to 10 different authors. There are 10 different books. You go to the author's page that you've created. You enter your name and email, and the author then sends you a digital copy of the book, or do they get a physical copy? What do they get?
Yeah, so they go to a landing page that has the book covers of all the books and a timer. So we run an event for 2 days, so it's a 48-hour window. And they click on whichever book cover they're interested in. It has the description from Amazon, which we formatted, and mm-hmm. they just enter their email address, and it takes them straight to the download page for the book.
Nice.
When that happens, it then immediately adds to, each landing page is customized, so it goes to a Google Sheet for that author. Mm-hmm. So the authors can actually see the email addresses, because some authors want to be really proactive and they could see them coming in real time, and they can add them to their autoresponders in real time and do all of those things. So they have instant access to the people that have chosen their book, and it allows people to select. It's a short window of time, so it's not a huge ask. And it is a way to get people really excited about your book again, because they go, mm-hmm. oh my gosh, I've never heard of this author, but if the author I like recommends them, then it's going to be interesting.
Okay. All right. So you do it for 48 hours, which is really, really cool. I like the time limit. And yeah, you're going to see some people downloading your stuff. It's similar to what we do with giveaways and bundles, but obviously different in terms of the authorship side of it, which I really like. When you and I first spoke a couple of weeks ago, sort of formulating what this episode would be like, we got into a really cool conversation about getting reviews. And at the time, I was still planning an online book launch for a client of mine, and we got into this like really interesting conversation about it. Can you share a little bit more about the strategy? You were telling me at the time that Amazon only shows like the first 8 reviews, so it's important to have those first 8 reviews and then consistently update it with good reviews and things. How do you get people to give good reviews? I find that's really hard. And how do you continuously engage people to give reviews over time versus just like during that quote unquote launch period?
Sure. So most books on Amazon have 0 reviews.
Yeah.
Like 90% of them have 0. And this is a hard lesson. Every author comes to me and says the same thing. Oh, I've got a ton of friends and family. My mom, I'll never forget this. She offered me $20 so I don't have to read my book. My book hit number 2 on all of Amazon.
Oh my God. She's like,
yeah. So and everyone does that. I, all the time, as part of my job, people are like, ask me to read their book all the time. And I always think the same thing. I always think, oh, I should just offer them $20, not read it. I think about that all the time because I feel the same way. So you're asking someone to do something huge because you're asking for their time. And that's a big, big ask. So the first thing is you have to have a strategy. Most people just don't. They think it's going to be easy. It's not. It's very hard because nobody wants to be the first anything. So you have to create a lot of momentum. So the best kind of an, you have to have two different strategies. The first one is, yeah, getting to the first eight. That's the magic number. After eight, it doesn't matter because Amazon only shows eight on any listing page. They will never show nine reviews on a book listing page. So you don't have to worry about it. What happens is if people see your book and they only see three reviews on the page, they'll notice. They might not know why, but they go, something's missing. And they'll have that feeling that something is missing. So there's a bunch of things that you want to do as part of the process. And I'll just walk through. And the first thing is you want to make it easy for people to leave reviews. So the first thing is you can actually create a link that some people call it a super link that takes people straight to the review page for your book. Because it's tricky. You actually have to go to a page. If you go on Amazon and you go to find the book, then you have to go to the review section. You have to click a little box that says leave a review.
Yep.
And it's actually really complicated. So creating a short link, that's the first step. The second step in the process, and then I make a redirect. So if it's like mywebsite.com/review or / the name of the first word of the book review, like Orbit review or 20K review for one of my books, that makes it easy. The second thing that I did that I didn't know would be such a success is I wrote a blog post about how to leave a video review on Amazon. So that people, that's why my book has a bunch of video reviews on it. And I would just send people an email with a link to that post. That blog post gets a ton of SEO traffic. So people who are, in general, want to write or leave a video review on Amazon, my blog post is still the go-to. I had no idea that would happen, but it was like, just make it easy for people, explain the process. So that's the first thing you have to do. Make it as easy as possible. The second thing is at the end of your book, you want to be strategic. People forget, or they use the end pages in poor ways a lot. Like they annoy people with like a barrage of offers, or like, here's a, remember sometimes books, like especially science fiction books, will have like a one page description of like 10 different books by 10 different authors at the end. And I'm like, what is happening here?
Yeah.
Like being at the back of a magazine in the 80s. I don't know what's happening, but I don't, it like makes me jump off the book. I don't read the end of it. There's two things that will make a huge difference in your results. The first is you have to have a page that says, hey, did you find a typo? And you want, I send people to my website as a little form they can fill and tell me which book it is and tell me about the typo. And then I get an email and then I fix the book. And I say something along the lines of, hey, if you found a typo in this book, please tell me right here so I can fix the book. And everyone who reads the book after you won't have to face that typo. You can make this book better. This is specifically to stop the grammar reviewer sniper, because a bad grammar review can actually kill your book. A bad grammar review is so bad that it will, your book will go from 1,000 sales a day to zero if one of those pops up. They're so, and the people that do it are monsters. They actually actively do want to kill your book. And it will be, I've had it where they're wrong. Even people leave a bad grammatical review and they're actually incorrect. And I've also had where after 10,000 readers, someone found a mistake. I was like, wow, there's still one in there. So it's a really good tool to actually make the book better and to specifically stop the most dangerous type of review, which is, oh, this person wrote, this book was obviously written in Russian and then translated by Google Translate, like, or this book was written by someone who did not edit it. Those are brutal reviews.
They're brutal. Yeah.
Because they attack a part of the book that will stop people from reading it right out the gate. And it works. I mean, if I see that in a review, it also stops me. So that's really important. And I saw that in someone else's book and I go, this is genius. The second thing you want to have is a ask for the review. And I've seen one version of this in fiction, which is really, really cool. And this is where I learned it from. If you've ever seen the movie, The Neverending Story, or read The Neverending Story, hopefully I'm not spoiling the movie. It's from 40 years ago, but
literally I have the book behind me, The Neverending Story.
But the beauty of The Neverending Story is that if you don't read the book, the nothing comes and kills everyone.
Yeah.
So a book is only alive as long as people are reading it, right? It's like the modern version of, oh, if a tree falls in the woods and no one hears, it doesn't make a sound. If a book exists and no one reads it. So it's really good. And she's like, say my name, Bastion. Great movie, great story, right? And that's, they had this story about, oh, these two characters that were like in a almost like a comic book, which they're like being erased. And they're like, oh, if you don't leave a review, we're going to get nothing. So he wrote it really well. I wish I could remember which author it was just in a book. And I saw that and I thought that was brilliant. So you actually create a story where, again, it's breaking the fourth wall. And the character's like, listen, if you want a sequel, if you want another book in this series, you matter. And that will compel people. For nonfiction, I say, listen, I'm an independent author. I'm not with a big publishing house. Your review is significant. because the way it works is how many reviews do I have lately? Even if you see a lot of reviews, it's how many reviews I have recently, and it makes a difference. So your review can actually help me to stay in business, help me to write more books and sell more books, because I need that revenue to have the time to write the next book.
Where are you tell putting that in the book though? Are you putting it in the front of the book, the back of the book?
So those are the last two pages. Page?
Okay.
So last goes typo page. I think it goes typo. It goes, okay, at the end of the book, it goes free gift, whatever my free gift is, like one last chance at the free gift. Then it goes other books by Jonathan, typo. Mm-hmm. Those two might switch back and forth and then ask for the review. The last thing they see is ask for the review, because when people are reading on a Kindle device, what happens is it then shows that option to leave the review right there. And you at least want them to click the rating. Even if they'll leave a review, if they just hit the 5-star thing, it makes a difference. So totally. You just go, hey, on the next page, if you're going to see this thing. And if you're reading a paperback, here's a link to go to the page where you can leave a review. Just pull out your phone right now and it makes a huge difference. I want that to be the last thing I say to them, because that's the action I want them to take right then. Significant action.
Absolutely. Somebody, a friend of mine just published a book and it's self-published. She put in QR codes into the book. Did she use those to, like, the QR code leads right to, you know, the review page or whatnot. And then the other QR code was like to her freebie and things like that. And so she used those. She even put them, like, she had like a little break. She broke the fourth wall right in the middle of the book. She's like, hey, if you're having a good time with this, why not, you know, preemptively, just so you know, you can get this free beat, like this free gift. And if you do this, blah, blah, blah. So it was really cool. I think QR codes are fun thing. And they're so easy to make now. They used to be hard. You used to have to go to like a certain page and sign up for a service. And now you can just do them in Canva. So much easier. Okay. So we've talked about reviews. We've talked about this online event, which I think is really, really cool. And you've had this incredible journey of writing so many books, obsessively writing books, which is kind of, you know, every author is like thinking, wow, how did he get to 300? But you were cranking out a book every, you know, week or so at one point, which is crazy. You don't do that anymore. Now you're a lot more selective and you have a completely different clientele, which is cool. What would be your insights or your process for ghostwriting and collaborating with other authors to kind of like get this process done?
So I've only done a few co-writes with other authors.
Yeah.
And you always have to have I don't do 50-50 co-writes. It never works that way when there's two captains of the boat. So one of you always has to be the dominant person. Sometimes it's me, sometimes it's the other person. Just usually it's like who has the bigger audience. That's the person who's dominant. So I have this ability to, the other person is just like, let them make the decisions and like not get emotionally invested, because you have to be able to disconnect your emotion from the book when it's not your own book, whether it's a co-writer or a ghostwriting job. So the most important thing is the ability to find the interesting. So the reason I'm a really good ghostwriter is not my writing. I'm not a very good writer. I'm okay. There are writers who are more eloquent. They have better metaphor. They tell these better stories. They have this just brilliant ability to write. That's not me. That's not where I shine. I'm really like consistency and quantity type person. So I write pretty good books and I write a lot of them, and they have good information that works, right? The instructions work, but a lot of people have no self-awareness about if they're being boring. Like every one of us has had someone in our lives tell us about one of their dreams. And there is nothing more boring than another person's dream. Just always.
Okay. You're okay. Calling me out. I'm always talking about my dreams. Therefore I must be boring.
Yeah. I mean, not your hopes and dreams about the future, but I mean, if you had a dream last night and you're telling someone what happened, yeah, now you know, because you're telling something about something that's not real at all. So it's like
totally
really disconnected. Sorry, but it's just,
no, it's cool. It's funny. I just have very vivid dreams and I end up telling my partner about them. I'm like, I had this crazy dream last night, and I make the connection now. Okay. I'm sorry. I probably won't do that again.
Well, that's what I mean. It's, we don't, I found out the same way when someone said it to me at one point. I go, oh my gosh, now I get it. Because so I have a really short attention span. So I interview someone, and if it's boring, I change the subject. I'm like, stop, it's boring. I don't say that, but sometimes I want to. I'm always trying to drive them towards the interesting. So I have this ability that comes from my dating life, which is to find the interesting. So When I was single guy, right, and you're going out and you meet a lady in a bar or whatever, and then her husband walks up, the standard thing to do is to slink away and be like, oh, and it's like, well, I haven't done anything wrong because I didn't know you were married, right? I was just talking to someone, she was in the bathroom. So I developed this ability where usually me and the husband will end up having a bunch of drinks together and neither of us are talking to her because me and him become best friends. What I do is I collect jobs. I want to meet one person who's had every job. So I always say, what do you do? And if it's something new, especially, I get really excited. And most people don't think their job is interesting because it's so consistent for them. But there's all these small parts that are very interesting to me because it's a world I don't know. Like the person who does the flashlights for a plane on the runway, he goes, it's not that important. I go, really? What if you do this when you're supposed to do that? And he's like, oh, two planes crash and $50 million of damage is done. I was like, you have a lot of power with two flashlights. Those people have so much power. And that's very, like, that was interesting. I met someone who was in charge of, when you're having surgery, they hand the tool to the nurse who hands it to the surgeon. And I was like, you have to learn all the names for every single tool. He was in charge of cleaning and counting. Counting is really important. How many tools do we use? How many tools came back? Because for a while they weren't counting and stuff was getting left behind in people. So
yep.
Really a job that I would find very stressful. And this person, like, I think he hadn't even graduated high school, right? So he didn't have high education. I was like, yeah, but like the nervousness, right? Having nerves of steel. So I'm very interested in that. So if I'm interested in something, I'll ask a lot of questions, even when the person doesn't think they're interesting. So I'm chasing that interesting. So when I'm talking to a client, I'm looking for the interesting. And when things are boring, I don't put it in the book. I'm just like, look, we can't put this in. This is boring. And that's really important because a lot of people want to write a biography and nobody reads biographies unless you're already famous. I've read one biography in the last 10 years. Okay. It just, even when people buy celebrity biographies, they tend not to, I think they're the lowest rate of finished books of any book out there. They have a really low finish rate. People buy them, but only because they're already interested. So if you're already famous, fine. It's a way to monetize your celebrity a little bit. But so I help people to drive towards the interesting. And the second thing is that people will say to me, and I'm sure you're familiar with this, they go, listen, I don't know if this is interesting, but, and they go, I think this is probably boring. No one would care, but, and then they start the craziest story you've ever heard. So one of them was, this guy says to me, he's in his 80s. He goes, listen, so during the Vietnam War, I was actually a spy in Cambodia illegally. And then he goes, and after I came back, my wife was a spy in the Russian ballet and we were in Moscow for 10 years undercover. He goes, do you think people would find that interesting? And I was like, I'm sorry. Have you ever heard of movies? Have you heard of Mission Impossible? Like, I was like, you're literally describing the most interesting thing that anyone's ever said to me. Another one, someone said, I don't know if this is interesting, but I drive big rigs. I'm driving a truck, an 18 wheeler and it jackknifes on a rainy day and it's going sideways towards a gas station. I look at the gas station and I see like a family in a station wagon and I'm shooting towards the gas station. Is that interesting? And I was like, what is happening here? Like, it's sort of an action movie, right? And yep. So obviously the guy didn't die because he's telling me the story, but I want to know what happens. Another person says, I'm going up to parachute with a group of people. We're halfway up and the engine's cut out. We're too low to be able to jump out. We don't have enough altitude to jump out. The parachutes won't work at this low altitude and the door won't open. And then she was like, is that interesting? And I was like, what? So people who say that, they think they're boring. They have the most interesting stories. And people think they're interesting have the most boring stories almost always. So I help separate those two things. The second really critical part of especially nonfiction ghostwriting is to understand the reader. Most people think the purpose of a book is to demonstrate your deep and abiding knowledge and expertise on a subject. And that's not the purpose of a book. People hate smart people. People do not like you if you're too intelligent and people don't follow experts. And the example of this, I always say, listen, doesn't matter which political party you're on, I don't care. Let's say you're watching Fox News and an expert comes on and tells this story. Then the expert is on MSNBC. Are you going to switch and follow the expert? Or are you going to stay on Fox News and see the next guest and vice versa, right? Or whatever news channels you watch. I don't know all the names of them. So I don't have TV here. So I don't know those channels, but whatever channel you're watching, they don't follow the expert, right? So they don't jump and follow the expert from interview to interview. They follow the interviewer. Why do you follow the interviewer? Because you like them. Nobody thinks reporters are smart. Nobody thinks, I mean, I hope, nobody thinks TV reporters are smart because they're just teleprompter readers these days, right? They're not going undercover and bringing in a story like people did 50 years ago, but it's just like, oh, I'm reading a teleprompter and I have really great hair and I'm likable. That's their job, right? Just to be likable, not to be smart, which is fine. So the purpose of your book is to do two things. It's to demonstrate that you're likable. And the second thing is to show that you're not an idiot. You don't have to be a genius. You just have to be not idiot. So the bar isn't here for intelligence. It's here. Once you're pretty above low. Not idiot, well, a lot of people are idiots. A lot of people. And once you realize that, it removes, because people focus on all of the stuff. And what they do is they turn their book into a Thanksgiving dinner because they put in all of their knowledge. So someone reads the book and goes, okay, I know everything Jenny knows. I never need to read anything by her. Why would I go on a mailing list? I know the extent of her knowledge. Everything is in the book. When people feel that sense of fullness, that end of a Thanksgiving meal fullness and get sleepy, then you lose them. You actually get a worse effect. Mm-hmm. So want to leave people wanting more. So you want them to feel a sense that, okay, you've hit a waypoint, but that there's still more. And a great example, the best example of this is that TV show 24. 24 episodes in a row, I know three things are going to happen. Someone's going to get betrayed. Someone's going to die. Someone's going to get tortured. And it's going to turn out there's a secret person behind whoever we thought was the bad guy. And they will do 24 cliffhangers in a row, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, it's person A. At the end of episode one, you realize, oh my gosh, person A is actually being puppeted. There's a puppet master. That's in episode two. You find the puppet master. There's another puppet master. And there's 24 puppet masters in a row, which shouldn't work, but it's the best example of someone, they kept doing the same cliffhanger and it works. It's the best example of daisy chaining cliffhangers. That show was so successful for that reason. Mm-hmm. That every week, you're like, I got to find out who's behind this. And they just kept building it out, right? And it would always have these elements that are like so over the top, but it's just, you're so engaged because of that. So that's the cliffhanger, which is, okay, they caught a person. They still caught person A. So you have a sense of completion, but now I want to go to the next course. So when you're writing your book, you don't want to put everything you know. You want to put enough in to know they felt they got value, but then they also want to feel that there's more. That's kind of the balance that a lot of people, first-time writers, struggle that I'm able to find for them. Now, the likability element is also the tricky part because people think their most interesting story is their best story. And I learned this lesson the hard way about myself. So I took a course on how to tell interesting stories when you meet a lady, how to be interesting. Okay. It was like how to tell an interesting story. And here's the story I used to tell. And tell me if this would work on you as a lady. I was like, listen, I was climbing a mountain in Japan. I got lost. The sun set. I'm all by myself on a mountain. I think I'm going to die. I fall off a cliff and I get a scratch under my shirt. I'm afraid to look because I think my nipple's gone. So I know I can't look because I'll break down. Okay. I'm so thirsty. I'm starting to think about, okay, I'm going to have to pee in the canteen. Mm-hmm. And right before I have to do that, I get off the mountain and I survive, but I thought I was going to die. It's a really emotional story. I actually was thinking about my will. I'm never going to see my family again. 100% I thought I was going to die. Every single woman, when she hears that story, all they hear is, this guy almost drank his own pee. I'm not kissing him. That's all that they come away with, right? Wow. So it's right. That's the thing. It's an engaging story, but it's the wrong story.
Yeah.
So it's interesting, but it's not interesting if you're thinking about kissing that person because you start thinking that one thing, okay? And that's the lesson I learned because I was like, oh, interesting doesn't mean it's gets the result you want.
Especially depending on your ideal audience, yeah.
So that story is a great story in certain situations, but it's not, no one after hearing that thinks anything positive. They go, oh, I bet he has, you know, I didn't even do it, but they still think about it, right? And they go, he's probably lying. Maybe he did really do it. But that's all of that goes through their head. That's not the thought you want someone to have when you're trying to be flirtatious. So that's how I learned that lesson. But so a lot of people will tell me stories that are, they're the villain. One client I worked with, his story was like, he left his fiance at the altar and he's like, you have to put that in the book. I was like, if I do that, you're Darth Vader. You have to be the villain of the book. And it's a lot of people are very unlikable because they've grown up with advantages. So, but if you're self-aware, you can turn that around by being a positive person, kind of facing it. So what people want to know is that you know how they feel. And some of my clients are very successful. And I have to find that story that humanizes them. That's what I'm, the
But you didn't tell us the other story. You told us the one story on the mountain and you said, okay, let me tell you, I'm going to tell you two stories and which one's more interesting. What's the other one that you actually told from learning how to tell stories for dating? What was the other story?
Oh, the story. Okay. Yeah.
You got it. So, I mean, you left me with a cliffhanger. I need to know the other one.
Yeah, sure. So the other story that I tell, it's actually became the story that I tell in my book, Fire Boss, which is, you know, when I was younger, I was not a good athlete. I was always the chubby loser. But at my school, you had to do a sport. It was mandatory. It wasn't optional. So I was on the soccer team. I was the third string goalie for the soccer team. And my dad was a major athlete. My dad was almost a professional baseball player. Like, he got offered a contract to play professional baseball. He was like good enough. And so he was that close, really successful. And I was like, guess it skips a generation, right? And he had played against someone at a college game who was in the Hall of Fame now for baseball. So my dad played against great players and then got really close in all those adventures. So I'm not an athlete. My dad came to all my games, even though he's one of those dads who's working all the time. He still found a way to be at every game and even coached me when I was younger. So we're at this game and it's a JV game. So I'm only second string goalie, but I'm always just sitting on the bench. Everyone knows I'm not going to get to play because the goalie is one of those guys that can run. He's always doing stuff. So he's on like three sports teams. He's like winning medals and stuff. And he breaks his arm. And I go,
oh boy.
I'm in the Mighty Ducks. This just happened.
Yep.
My dad warms me up. It's freezing cold. My dad warms me up and I save the game. Okay. We win the game. I make the big save. It's like one of those moments. You're like, you don't think it's really going to dab you. It happens. So all my dreams came true, right? I got the game. My dad was there. I saved the game. We won the game. It was crazy. And then, you know, he's out for the season. Mm-hmm. Well, here's the twist. My coach takes this other guy, Doug, who's taller than me, and goes, Doug, you're a goalie now. You're going to learn how to be a goalie because Doug is taller than me, blonde hair, blue eyes. And the coach, each game, will put Doug in longer and longer. And every time Doug is in, we lose. Doug is terrible. So we played one game where Doug plays the first half. The other team scores four goals. I goalie the second half, they score one. So I'm four times, but every single time we play. And then the coach, however, keeps giving Doug more time and me less. And finally we play a game. We get to the point where we'll always have two people stand in the goal next to him, trying to head out all the balls because they know Doug is terrible. But the coach just gives him more and more time. The coach just doesn't like me. And we get to the final game of the season against our big rivals. It's the middle of the game. I get this, Doug gets first half. He lets in a ton of goals. We can't score any goals because everyone's playing defense to make up for him. And the coach just doesn't care because he likes this guy. I don't know if he likes him because he's taller than me. Yes, taller, but maybe also he's got blonde hair and blue eyes. I don't know. So I'm going in to get in and the coach says, actually, Doug's going to play the second half. We're already losing, by the way. So Doug's already let in like two goals. We're losing. And I said, and then I said some things I'd never talked to an adult like this before. I said some really dark stuff to this guy. I said, that's the reason you're the JV coach at your age. I was like, you're in your 60s. They won't even let you coach varsity because you make terrible decisions. I said, we will never win this game if you don't let me play in the goal. And then I said a whole bunch of curse words. I don't remember exactly what I said. I can't say them on your podcast. And I'd never talked to an adult like that before. And I turn around and my dad is right there. And I'm like, oh no, right? I'm about to suffer the consequences, as you
say. Absolutely. Suffer the consequences for your actions.
And my dad goes, you're right, you're right. And it like blew my mind that I didn't get in trouble. He goes, yeah, you know, and it's like, we lost the game by a lot. And like once he stopped letting me be the goalie for the whole game, we never won a game again. So it was like the story is the story about me and my dad.
Yeah. It's more about the dad and
And I tell a shortened version. I told you a longer version, but a shortened version of that. And because the reason it's a good story is because it's emotion. I actually feel emotions about it. I really feel probably like it's the most significant part of my high school experience is these two games. Whereas like I got to be the hero and then I got to curse out an adult and have a first connection with my dad.
Yeah.
Those two big moments. So I telling those stories resonates in a different way. So when I'm working with a client, I'm waiting for the story that makes them likable because when someone, you know how like nobody wants to learn about weight loss from the person who's always been skinny. It's like, you don't know what it's like. nobody wants to learn about wealth. So I worked on this project where all these people were in real estate and every single one of them had inherited money. Okay. I was like, oh, the story of this book is you need parents in real estate. That was really the story. The client I was working with, and the client was like a bad client because he wouldn't do a lot of my process. He wouldn't do the interviews. He would just like send me emails. He'd like say, oh, just use content from Wikipedia for this. And I was like, you interviewed these people and stuff. And he had a bunch of bad stories, but one of the people, his father gave him $500 million to start a business. And the guy said, a lot of people think my dad gave me all the money to start my first business, my first job. He goes, actually, it was my second job. And I thought that was so funny because it's such a self-awareness. He's like, no, I worked for one of my friends in college first, right? And I thought, at least they're aware of it. And they're kind of being like, listen, I know that this is an insane thing and they have an awareness of it. And it's very funny to say it's actually the second job.
The second job. Yeah. No doubt.
I was like, I thought that was very impressive. That person came up with another story is I work with someone who huge, he never has to work again. He's just made millions and millions and millions of dollars. And he's not likable because he's a little bit, I don't know, they use all these words now about spectrum and stuff. He's just someone who's a little bit abrasive, but not intentionally, right? Mm-hmm. He's just very analytical and not emotional in the way he talks. He's very, very good at sales. So everything he says is very well structured and very strategic. And I was interviewing him and like it took a long time. We got to this story about he fell out of a tree when he was a kid. His hand was like ripped open and he was freaked out. He's like, my hand's never going to work again. I've never had pain like this before. And his parents were like, what are we going to do? We can't afford to go to the doctor. And so they took him to a vet in another town to like sew up his hand. And he's like, I never want that for my kids. And I goes, that's why you chase money. I was like, this is the story. When you told me that story, I was like, I'm so good. I felt like in the groove, you know, when you feel like you're in the zone. So I'm always trying to find, and everyone has one of those stories. Everyone has the story of where they're the underdog. You can watch like America's Got Talent or American Idol, all these talent shows. It's 12 underdogs. They've figured out how to make everyone into an underdog and how to kind of tell everyone's version of their story. Cause everyone has had something bad happen to them. So
everybody
what I
loves that kind of story. Everybody wants that kind of story. They want to see somebody go from nothing or less than nothing to something.
Yeah. Nobody wants to see you go from rich to richer, right? So they want you, but the more successful you are, the more you have to do something to overcome it. So I always ask people this question. I say, what's the worst thing that's ever happened to you that I'm allowed to put in the book? And people will, the second half is really important because otherwise they'll just tell me a story and they go, don't put that in the book. And that's when people really open up. And it doesn't have to be high stakes. It has to be how it felt. So it can be, I was in a meeting and everyone was looking at me and I was so ashamed because I didn't know the answer. I felt like an idiot. I was like, why am I here? Right? That's high stakes for you, right? It's like, oh, I thought my parents were going to spank me. Or I thought, you know what I mean? I thought my parents were going to send me to military. It can be not actually life and death. It doesn't have to be, I was in the helicopter about to crash. But as long as it's high emotion for you, it'll be high emotion for the reader. And that's the shortcut to doing it because a lot of people think, I have to only show the success. And that's how most of your business is. Most people just want to see front of house, right? They don't want to know what's happening backstage. But when you have to add this element to a book because it's a long form content that lets people know you had a journey, that you know how they feel. That's what people want. The reason people like me is they go, Jonathan gets me. So people want that. So it's hard for people to talk about because it's usually like people will tell me about being in an abusive situation. People will talk about getting a diagnosis a lot. Everyone has a divorce or something like that, which is like your biggest failure. And the thing that's kind of crazy, but it's also very liberating is realizing that the worst thing that ever happened to you is when people will fall in love with you as a creator, as an author. So you have to open up. I sometimes talk about this as it's kind of like, Alexander the Great. Like he was like, oh, he fought at the front of the army. Don't know if that's really true, but that's the story, right? He led from the front. People, if you open up first, they'll open up to you. People have a natural desire to seek rapport because what happens? Okay. Example is this. is if I tell you there's someone in my family who's an addict, your natural response is to tell me about someone you know or in your family that's an addict. So you will open up as much as I open up. If I talk about being poor or being starving or almost dying, the more I reveal, the more you feel safe revealing, right? It's this kind of like a game of detente. And again, this is something I learned from dating as well. I was like, oh, if I tell a really personal story first, then she will feel comfortable opening up at the same level. I can't just say, oh, tell me something really personal about you. And then I go, and then I just wait. People don't like that. So I learned that. And I said, oh, that makes sense to me. So just from a lot of studying communication. So in the same way, if you reveal something in a book, then people feel comfortable revealing it back to you. So those things are kind of why that matters, is they go, oh, because I want to follow someone or connect with someone who knows how I feel. I don't want to, I can't connect with someone who's just always had success and they don't know what it's like to struggle. People want, because everyone struggles in some area of their lives, right? That's really the beauty of the thing. People think that nonfiction is supposed to be dry and just informational and instructional. It's not. It's supposed to be fiction that happened. That's the only difference. So you have some teaching, but it's wrapped in these different stories. Right. So when you want to write a biography, it's like you can use stories from your life as long as they are leading towards a point for each chapter. Like the story has to be there for a reason, not just because you think it's interesting. And when you do that, that's when you can create a story that pulls people and they read the entire book. And at the end of the book, they feel like they know you well enough to want to read your next book or to give you their email address or to go visit your social media or to learn more about you. Any of those things that comes from being vulnerable in the book.
That's amazing. We could keep talking about this. Unfortunately, I actually do have a time limit on this podcast, so I'm going to have to wrap it up. But I appreciate all the stories that you've told. There's been a lot of more context than even I anticipated us talking about, which is really great. I talk about list building and lead generation and launches. We got into some particulars, and I think that we can pull some of this into the different elements of either if you want to write a book or even if you're writing really good long form content. Stories are great. I think a lot of people struggle with that. So you've shared a lot of great stuff. Thank you so much, Jonathan. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. And how can people find you, get in touch with you? We're going to have everything in the show notes, but go ahead and share.
Sure. The best place to find me is just Serve No Master. If you Google it or you go to servemaster.com, every result is me. So the first 100 results are all me or my social media or my podcast. That's ways you can find me. And if you visit my website, I have some amazing free gifts to help you get started, kind of secrets to becoming a bestseller. I'm always giving away some of my cool new AI tools that I'm using to grow my business. So please come have a visit and hang out for a while.
It's a cool looking website. I've been there a couple of times. Thank you so much, Jonathan. And we're going to make sure that all of that is in the show notes so you can get that everywhere that you're listening to the podcast. And thank you so much again. And as always, the Acquire Podcast is edited and produced by Jason Wheeler. And if you found this today's episode to be valuable, please make sure you do subscribe, leave a review, let me know what you think. I'd love to get your feedback. And I always appreciate you being part of my growing community. So consider joining my Facebook group, where I'm excited to deliver lots of great content, content that empowers entrepreneurs and marketers with list building, lead generation, and launches. Thank you so much. And the Acquire Podcast is brought to you by the Audphonic Podcast Network. Take care.